following interviews and commentaries are for entertainment only. The views and opinions expressed therein are those of the individual speakers and callers and do not necessarily represent the views of KFAR Radio or any of our respective employees, affiliates, or sponsors of this program.
It's time again for Shooter's Corner on KFAR Radio with the latest news and conversation related to firearms and your Second Amendment rights. Sponsored by Rogers Auto Repair, Arctic RV, Auto Trim Design, and Frontier Outfitters. And now, Shooter's Corner on KFAR Radio.
Welcome, listeners. This is Shooter's Corner with Laura Berkowitz, KFAR Radio. Please call in throughout the hour to join us, 458-8255-458-TALK. What's on your mind about firearms today? It's another great day in Fairbanks. It's overcast and minus 6 degrees downtown. And here at the KFAR broadcasting station, Melissa is back with us after being in Anchorage at her son's hockey tournament. And thank you, Melissa, for running the board. The archives should be up to date if you've missed any programs. So what's on our agenda today? Our holiday today is about a cake. And for history, we'll briefly discuss the Spanish flu. I thought I might intermittently add another category to the program when there isn't a good gun-related holiday or history to discuss, and that was my dilemma today. I was thinking about a new segment titled The Smartest Person in the Room. And that would be some fun gun facts now and then. You would know them, but maybe your friends would not. And if I have time, I also want to briefly talk about an opinion piece I read in the Newsminer. And later, our main topic is from Guy Smith's books, Guns and Control. We'll continue to discuss gun availability and its relationship to crime. Now, last week we discussed the subject by taking the 1,000-foot view. We looked to see if we could find any relationship between the United States and foreign countries concerning the availability of guns in the hands of the public related to homicides. And Guy Smith taught us that it is difficult to draw any conclusions. So this week we'll talk about the relationships between gun availability and homicides from state to state and local venue to local venue. Today, March 4 of a year, is National Pound Cake Day. And why do we call it a pound cake? Well, traditionally, a pound cake is made with a pound each of four ingredients, flour, butter, eggs, and sugar. And of course, when you take the pound cake out of the oven, it doesn't weigh 4 pounds because the moisture evaporated. Now, a recipe for pound cake was found in the first cookbook ever printed in the United States. The book was titled American Cookery, and it was published in 1796. And it said that the pound cake was first created in Northern Europe during the early 1700s, and now they're made in many parts of the world. Each country has added its own unique ingredients from its own culture. Now, pound cake is only tangentially related to anything about guns, but with much effort, I did find something from an article titled History of the First South Carolina Rifles. That is the first regiment rifles known as Orr's Rifles. It was organized in South Carolina in 1861. It was a South Carolina infantry regiment that served in the Confederate States Army during the Civil War. And initially, the regiment was posted to Sullivan's Island to defend Charleston Harbor, and they were mainly garrison troops standing as guards. A quote from CivilWarTalk.com, quote, "In that role, they earned the derisive nickname the Pound Cake Regiment. For their comparatively laid-back lifestyle, the local civilians often visited Sullivan's Island, bringing home baked goods to the troops. The initial size of the regiment was larger than usual at over 1,500 men during these early months of its service," unquote. Now, pound cakes were popular in the South during the Civil War, and I suspect the locals brought the troops pound cakes. Unfortunately, the regiment was soon called up and they fought hard in major battles. 344 officers and men were killed, another 201 died of disease, and 791 were wounded but not mortally. And despite their name, First Regiment Rifles, they were initially armed with Model 1842 smoothbore muskets. The U.S. Model 1842 musket was a 69 caliber musket. It was the last United States smoothbore musket. It had a percussion lock, and the percussion cap system is said to have been superior to the flintlock, more reliable and more resistant to weather. Its barrel was 42 inches in length, and overall the gun was 58 inches long, and it weighed 10 pounds. About 275,000 model 1842 smoothbore muskets were produced at the Springfield and Harper's Ferry armories between 1844 and 1855. But a small number were made by private contractors who used brass furniture instead of iron. I found a few auction prices. One model 1842 musket dated 1853 in good condition with a bayonet is priced at between $3,750 to $5,550, and another I found asks for an offer of $6,150. Now, moving on to some history. No one knows for sure when the first case of the Spanish flu came about, or who the first victim was. The early cases have been reported in Europe, parts of Asia, and the United States, and within months, it spread around the world. And from the history.com website, I learned that on this day, March 4th, 1918, a private Albert Gitchell woke up and felt awful. And he was the company cook at Camp Funston, which is now Fort Riley, Kansas. And that morning he would have been preparing breakfast for hundreds of American recruits waiting to be shipped off to the battlefields of France. Now, a doctor at Fort Riley recorded Gitchell's temperature at 103 degrees. And soon a Corporal Lee Drake appeared with similar symptoms. And then a Sergeant Adolph Herbie was next. And the men kept coming in sick. By lunchtime, 107 soldiers had reported sick, and by the end of the week, there were 500 more. And by the end of March, 1,127 men at Fort Riley had the flu, and by then, 46 of them had died. As our men shipped off to Europe, the conditions there were ripe for the flu to spread, and by the end of 1920, it's thought that 500 million people contracted the flu, and at least between 50 and 100 million died from it. Now, in truth, in foreign locations, adequate medical records and counts were not even kept. Among those who died were approximately 675,000 Americans. So why do we call it the Spanish flu? Well, during the First World War, there were reporting restrictions, wartime news blackouts among the combatant nations, and Spain was neutral, so it did not have these reporting restrictions. The news carried freely from Spain, so reports of devastation from the flu emanated from Spain. And progress of the flu in Spain got the most attention worldwide because reporting about the flu there was more frequent and in more detail. Hence, the flu was named the Spanish flu. However, at that time, the Spanish people believed the flu had come from France, so the Spanish people called it the French flu. And that is all I have for history today, and I could not find any connections to guns. Now, one of the reasons I'm spending so many weeks talking about statistics, as I said before, is so that we are smart when we read statistics about firearms. In the News Miner this last week, perhaps you noticed an opinion letter titled A Visionary Path to Responsible Gun Ownership. What annoyed me was the author's quote of various databases and statistical studies to allegedly prove her point. If you've been listening to Shooter's Corner, you could sort out what might or might not be correct. Of particular interest was that the author cited statistics we debunked through Guy Smith's work on what is behind the statistics. That was the author's site of, quote, children, teen death, CDC wonder, five-year average, 2015 to 2019, ages 0 to 19, unquote. We debunked this lumping together of children, teens, ages 0 to 19 years of age, and we sorted out through numerous disassociated causes of gun accidents and deaths in these groups. We're going to go to commercial, and I'll see you around the corner, and we'll finish this up.
Out in Arizona where the bad men are, the only thing to guide you is an evening star. The roughest, toughest man by far was Ragtime Cowboy Joe. He got his name from singing to the cows and sheep. Every night they say he sings the herd to sleep.
In a bass voice rich and deep, crooning soft and low.
He always sings raggedy music to the cattle as he swings back and forward in his saddle on a horse that is syncopated, gated there.
was such a funny meter to the roar of his.
Getting out to play in Alaska is a year-round activity. So before you leave home, make sure your trailer is ready to roll. Wheel bearings to wiring and lights. Have it serviced at Arctic RV. Motorhomes, toy haulers, campers, bodywork to appliances. See their huge selection of RV parts as well. Alaska plays rough. Make sure you and your RV are ready for it with Arctic RV. Book your appointment now. Rough it in style. Arctic RV. Open all winter long at 30th and Pegger.
Hi, Steve with Auto Trim Design here. When I hear lights and sirens, I'm reminded of how fortunate we are to have our dedicated and heroic response personnel watching over us. Because many times someone's life is on the line. Chances are we've installed those lights and equipped that vehicle with sirens, comms, and cameras. I'm proud that my team is picked for the dependable installations they need, as it shows how dependable our work is at Auto Trim Design. So if you're looking for accessories to outfit your personal rig, depend on the best. Depend on Auto Trim Design, 2550 South Cushman.
KFAR weather.
Mainly clear skies today with highs around 12. Winds out of the east, 5 to 10 miles per hour. Lows level off around 2 below. Tonight, partly cloudy skies. Highs level off around 16. Tomorrow, cloudy skies expected. About an inch of snow tomorrow night. And that's your weather on KFAR, 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm weatherology meteorologist Laura Lockwood. Currently, it's 7 degrees below zero.
Weather brought to you by GCR. Cooper and Bridgestone Tires for everything you tow and every car, truck, motorhome, and SUV you drive. GCR Tires and Service, the Tire Guys. Taming the Alaskan Road, Van Horn at Cushman.
And now, back to Shooter's Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM and 660 AM. Streaming live at KFARradio.com.
This is Shooter's Corner with Laura Berkowitz, KFAR Radio. Please call in 458-8255, 458-TALK, and tell us what's on your mind about firearms today. And we have a caller who hung on through the commercials, and you're on the air, caller.
Thank you, Laura. This is Ron.
Hi, Ron.
And you have already exceeded my wildest expectations by going into that community perspective.
Oh, good. What are your comments?
Well, not only comments, but analysis.
Okay.
All right. Let's start out with the fact that the writer identified herself as a concerned citizen,
yes,
parent, and person interested in gun safety.
Yes.
To begin, a search of her background reveals that she is not simply that. She is an absolute anti-firearms activist.
Yes.
She is a professor of photographic art at the University of Alaska,
mm-hmm,
and has engaged in projects producing T-shirts that say I'm not a target and that,
yes,
sort of thing.
Yes.
All right. Now, if you go down, you quoted some of the statistics that,
mm-hmm,
she brought forward. If you go down and look at, and she did footnote it, I will give her that. If you go down to the footnotes, you will note that on at least three occasions she cites two particular people. I can't remember their names without looking directly,
mm-hmm,
at the article right now. But they are research academics.
Yes.
And they have done a great deal of research on firearms and related topics, firearms, crime, take your pick.
Yes.
And I looked up their research.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that research is of a very anti-gun nature.
Yes.
And I also found out who they did the research for.
Ah.
And it was Every Town,
yes,
Research.
Okay, yeah.
I believe we can translate that Bloomberg and what's the woman's name? I forget. But
yeah.
Anyway, Moms Against Guns or something.
Yeah.
But at any rate, if you think about that and have any degree of knowledge about research, you will note that the research that you were doing had better conform to the results that the folks paying you want.
Absolutely.
Or else your funding will absolutely dry up.
Yes.
So I think we can put that in a category of non-statistical statistics.
Yes, you are right. And I'm looking, I printed out the article, and the I think the people that you're talking about that she cited was Ted Miller and David Swedler. Was that?
Though that is absolutely correct.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Well, I just just wanted your listening audience out there to understand exactly who we're dealing with here and what the background and basis in fact is.
I appreciate that. I appreciate your calling, and I have a few more comments on that. I actually had to think twice whether I wanted to bring this up today. I try to bring us new and happy things, but I think this is something that we need to think about, and especially in our community. So,
well, and if you go back a few days earlier,
yep,
in the newspaper, you'll find an article by a fellow that talked about all us folks running around out in the boondocks hunting with our fatigues and grenade launchers.
Yeah, logical gun rights, letters to the editor. Yep, I printed that
exactly
one out too.
And I did respond to that and actually called the man a FUD.
Well,
for which I was sternly raked over the coals, but obviously some people have no ability to read or think critically, so I can deal with that.
Yeah. It's such an emotional subject, but I really appreciate you calling in and talking about this.
All right. You have a great day, Laura.
Okay, you too. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. And that was Ron, and I really appreciate that. And let me just finish up on my impressions, which parallel a lot to Ron's impressions. We had already talked about the debunking of the lumping together of children and the disassociated causes of their gun accidents and deaths. And we talked about that on January 7th and the 17th Shooter's Corner program, so you can listen to those in the archives if you missed them. Now, another statistic in this opinion piece, quote, 93% of American voters support requiring background checks on all gun sales, including 89% of Republicans and 87% of gun owners. That includes Alaska, unquote. Could any of our listeners please tell me how and at what cost any survey group could survey 93% or more of American voters? Clearly, these numbers are extrapolated from a much smaller sample, the source of which we do not know and wasn't provided in the opinion piece. And this is all to prove someone's agenda. So the author of this article claims she's for gun safety. That's great. A lot of us are for gun safety. So let me explain another way of doing gun safety. Let me explain how my co-instructors and I are for gun safety, and I know a lot of our listeners feel the same way. We actively spend many hours each month teaching gun safety to youth and adults, and that means we're hands-on, helping students learn to handle their guns safely, watching them, correcting them, and making sure they understand what we tell them. And as the classes progress, we watch the students demonstrate back to us their understanding of the safety measures we just taught them. And we make sure the students in our classes leave not only understanding gun safety, but also how to participate in the sport or whatever gun endeavor they want to. And we make sure the students know where they can practice and who they should go to for further training. And our class pays, we pay for their range IDs at the Fish and Game Range so that they will have a place to practice. And I wonder if the person who wrote this opinion piece ever took a gun safety or a gun handling class. I wonder if she ever read Guy Smith's book, Guns and Controls, or John Lott Jr.'s book, More Guns, Less Crime, Understanding Crime and Gun Control Laws, or Gary Kleck's book, Targeting Guns, Firearms and Their Control. So what can we do? What can we listeners do in our community? We can all be safe with our guns. We can teach our youth to be safe with guns, and we can make sure that unauthorized persons cannot access our guns. And what we don't need to do is to quote to the public statistics and numbers that are chosen just in such a way as to promote an agenda. And that is all I have to say about that. You are all welcome to call in with your comments, and thank you, Ron, for yours. And actually, I'm going to be talking about some of this later in the program today, and if I don't get to it, I will next week, of how Guy Smith's statistics show us a completely different reason for the availability of firearms and how these problems are caused in the first place. So I want to move on to something I was thinking about, the smartest person in the room tip. But before I get started with that, I wonder how many of our listeners knew that Joe Nava was a member of Mensa International. Now, Mensa is an organization with chapters in 100 countries with members of all ages. And the criteria for being a Mensen is to have a high IQ. Now, you have to either take an IQ test administered by Mensa or submit another approved test, and you have to score within the top 2% of the population. In fact, Joe Nava used to proctor the test here in Fairbanks for those who wanted to test their IQ to see if they could be Mensa members. Joe always told me, all Fairbanksians have high IQs. All Fairbanksians are Mensens. And I suppose we have to be smart to figure out how to survive here. Now, Joe joined Mensa to promote educational activity for gifted youth. He felt there were many programs across our nation at the time to help youth learn the basics, but he felt, and this was maybe about 50 years ago, that if a family didn't have a great deal of money, there were not many programs to bring together, enrich, and challenge youth with high IQs. If you read Joe's book, Not Your Average Joe, or listened on Shooter's Corner when I read chapters, you'll remember that Joe grew up poor. His family was very poor. They did not have money. And Joe almost flunked out of high school. He almost didn't graduate. And that's in his book. Now, clearly, as an adult, he finished his master's degree. He did important work in our community and raised a family of five, and he became a Mensen. But back when Joe was a kid, there were no programs for poor youth like Joe to help challenge him academically. And I got to thinking that now and then on Shooter's Corner, it would be fun to learn about and share with you an interesting gun fact that many people might not know, and we could be gun fact Mensens. Now, let me start this one off. States have official things. This Alaska state's tree is the Sitka spruce. Our flower is the forget-me-not. Our bird is the willow ptarmigan. Our state fish is the king salmon. Our state food is the salmon. Our mammal is the moose. Our motto is north to the future. Our state dog is the Alaska Malamute. Our state insect is not the mosquito. It's the four-spot skimmer dragonfly. So I learned something. I thought it was the mosquito. Our state marine, Melissa's laughing. Okay. Our state marine mammal is the bowhead whale. Our state fossil is the woolly mammoth. Our gem is jade, and our state mineral is gold. Our song is the Alaska flag song, and our state sport is dog mushing. But here's the important fact. Do any of our listeners know what our state firearm is? I had no idea we had a state firearm. There are 8 states in the United States that have adopted a state firearm: Alaska, Arizona, Indiana, Kentucky, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, Utah, and West Virginia. Now, you can Google state firearms and see the list. Utah claimed the 1911 pistol because John Browning was a native of Ogden, Utah. Kentucky took the Kentucky Long Rifle. Arizona adopted the Colt Single Action Army Revolver. And Alaska, no one's called in yet. Do any of our listeners know? Well, in July 2014, Alaska adopted the pre-1964 Winchester Model 70 as our state firearm. And then Senate President Charlie Huggins sponsored the bill, referring to the gun as the rifleman's rifle. From Wikipedia, quote, "The bill says the gun helped Alaskans establish a firm foothold in the wilderness between 1930 and 1953, unquote. The bill was signed by then-Governor Sean Parnell. And who knows, you might be the smartest person in the room now that you know that. The pre-1964 Winchester Model 70. And tell everyone you learned that on Shooter's Corner. Now, I want to, let's see here, I've got about 2 minutes before we go to commercial break, so I'm just going to get started here. I want to finish up Guy Smith's Guns and Control chapter on gun availability, and frankly, that'll probably go into next week to finish it up, and how to interpret the statistics we read on the availability of guns in the hands of public and how that relates to crime. Last week, we covered the 1,000-foot view, the United States compared to other countries around the world. We learned that it was difficult, if not impossible, to make those statistical comparisons because, first, most of the data for international comparisons of homicides per capita or per 100 population are provided by the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crimes. And though countries agree on what a dead person is, not all agree on what constitutes a homicide. The second is, remember, in Smith's chart, Uganda was has the least guns per capita, but the highest homicide rate. And it's a mistake to think all those homicides were done with firearms. They're done with machetes and other means. We just can't know the percentage of worldwide homicide statistics that are connected to firearms. Third, sample size makes a difference. Some reports rely on data based on such small samples that the results are statistically irrelevant. And fourth, to make proper comparisons from country to country for how the number of guns per capita affects homicides, Guy Smith suggests that perhaps we need to compare nations together by using a socioeconomic index that accounts for both wealth and population. But we learned that has problems too. How do you compare the United States with China? And we're going to stop here, go to break, and I'll finish up around the corner.
Talk radio station that's in full stereo. We are KFAR.
Fox News, I'm Karen McHugh. Senate Republicans trying to delay passage of the COVID relief bill.
It's rare for legislation to be read in full on the Senate floor, but Wisconsin Republican Ron Johnson is forcing a reading of the $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan.
Shine the light on this abusive an obscene amount of money that's going to further mortgage our children's future.
The exercise could take several hours. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer says he welcomes it.
Fox's Jared Halpern. Democrats still have the votes to pass the measure. California prioritizes its share of the COVID vaccine.
40% of California's vaccine supply will apparently be set aside and go to the most vulnerable areas of the state, according to the Associated Press. The set aside will go to 8 million people in about 400 zip codes.
Fox's Jessica Rosen. America is listening to Fox News.
It's time for your Alaska News Minute.
The U.S. Coast Guard has suspended its search in waters off Alaska for an overdue helicopter piloted by the former head of Alaska's largest tribal health care organization. Andy Tuber is the former head of the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. He resigned last week after allegations of sexual misconduct surfaced against him. Tuber left Anchorage on Tuesday in a black and white Robinson R-66 helicopter en route to Kodiak Island. He did not arrive, prompting the search. A former assistant at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium accused Tuber of sexual misconduct. He abruptly resigned last week but denied the allegations. And finally, the fate of the 2021 Alaska tourism season is still very much an unknown for the large international cruise lines that operate vessels with thousands of passengers. But small vessel operators are preparing to get back to touring the Inside Passage. Alaska Dream Cruises is one of those companies in the unique position of falling outside the strict guidelines imposed on the large cruise companies. Cruise line representatives have additionally floated the possibility that Canadian officials could be more receptive to limited and strategic port calls if COVID-19 national case counts generally remain on the downward trajectory and many cruise passengers have been vaccinated.
Streaming live online at KFAR660.com.
Extend the life of your car or truck. Keep it in top shape with Rogers Auto Repair. Rogers is a complete auto shop. They do it all. Tune-ups to winterizing. Even engine and transmission rebuilds right on the premises. Depend on the people with experience and a sound reputation. They've been helping folks from the same location near the airport on Dale Road since they opened in 1967. Call family-owned and operated Rogers Auto Repair and be their next satisfied customer. Call 479-6665. Rogers Auto Repair.
When you love being outside, you know that winter in Alaska is just another trail to more sporting opportunities. And when it comes to gearing up, the place to do it is Frontier Outfitters. Whatever it is, small game hunting, predator calling, ice fishing, and more, Frontier has what you need to be prepared and successful. You'll find the guns, ammo, optics, GPS equipment you're looking for, plus traps, snares, and the right winter clothes. Winter camping necessities as well. Visit Frontier Outfitters. It's the best start to a successful outdoor adventure. For your Alaskan lifestyle, Frontier Outfitters.
Hi, Steve with Auto Trim Design here. When I hear lights and sirens, I'm reminded of how fortunate we are to have our dedicated and heroic response personnel watching over us. Because many times someone's life is on the line. Chances are we've installed those lights and equipped that vehicle with sirens, comms, and cameras. I'm proud that my team is picked for the dependable installations they need, as it shows how dependable our work is at Auto Trim Design. So if you're looking for accessories to outfit your personal rig, depend on the best. Depend on Auto Trim Design, 2550 South Cushman.
And now, back to Shooter's Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM and 660 AM. Streaming live at KFARradio.com.
This is Shooter's Corner with Laura Berkowitz, KFAR Radio. Please call in 458-8255-458-TALK and tell us what's on your mind about firearms today or opinion pieces in the Newsminer. And before I get started, I want to let you know that Glenn Miller is back in town and I'll be talking to him soon. So hopefully I'll have some dates for you by next week when he'll be back on the program. And don't forget, he's got his metallic reloading classes scheduled. Go to the aimcom.org website. The one for March that's coming up is full. He's got only two spaces left for his April 17 class. That's from 9 to 6 p.m. on one day, on a Saturday. And his June 12 class is also scheduled. So April 17 or June 12, if you're thinking about taking that class, those would be good dates to take it. And remember, you can take it with, if you have a family and you've got a 16-year-old or older, take it as a family. Take your kid with you to learn together. Now, we left off, I think I mentioned 4 points that we've already discussed. Let me just finish up the fifth one and then we'll move forward. The fifth item that we've learned this last week was the negatives of comparing countries goes on and on and on, and it would be difficult to ever accurately, reliably compare one country's gun availability and homicide rate with that of another country. So that was the 1,000-mile view, and let's move close up. Let's talk about within our own country. Now, Guy Smith transitions from the macro view to the local view in a section titled Street Crime and Its Gun Sources. And this is where we're going to start today. To quote Smith's humor, he's so humorous, the first sentences are, quote, "Living an urban lifestyle comes with risks. Aside from rats, politicians, and other unsavory creatures, one of the added hazards of life in the big city is getting shot," unquote. Now, according to Smith, firearms homicides are 97% higher in metro areas than all other levels of urban environments. And he points out that if you live in a metro area, if you want to cut your chances of being shot in half, just drive a distance out of the big city you're in. For our purposes, talking about gun statistics, a big city is referenced to in Guy Smith's book as a large metro area, and the adjoining suburbs are referred to as the large fringe metro. Now, Smith's reasons for why homicides are 97% higher in large metro areas and half that in the suburbs, the large fringe metro, are, first, large metro areas, there's simply more opportunity for both street crime and spontaneous violence. Spontaneous violence would be a fistfight outside a bar, or we've seen over the past year an altercation sometimes deadly during protests or other activities in public spaces. And Smith says violent crime in the United States is about 23% higher in the top 20% of the cities ranked by population than in the bottom 20%. And Smith uses the term population convivence. And I had not heard that term, so I looked it up. Convivence means to carouse together, because con means together and vivere means to live. So population convivence means, for Smith's purposes, where population lives together in large numbers or closer together. So population convivence. That mere population convivence drives crime, including gun crime. Now, the second reason why there's more crime in large metro areas is street gangs. And we haven't talked about suicides and guns yet, but Smith points out that just as, quote, "suicides have some very specific demographics, so too do gangs and urbanization. Street gangs inhabit and conduct homicides primarily with firearms, mainly in the big cities of America," unquote. Now, Smith posits that in our country, we have a big problem with gang participation. And he says there are no absolute international comparisons from one country to another concerning crime and street gangs, but that criminologists around the world have attempted to make local gang estimates in foreign cities. In the United States, according to Smith, and I'll quote, the ratio of street gang members in American cities compared to cities abroad is staggering. Chicago, Illinois has a population of about one-third of London, England. However, Chicago has a street gang participation rate that is 314 times higher than London's, unquote. So going further, we learned that it isn't just Chicago. But rather than comparing the American cities to cities in other countries, suffice it to say that Smith says, quote, way back in 2012, the National Gang Center estimated there were over 850,000 gang members in the United States and that 80% of them were in large metro areas, unquote. Now, Smith provides numbers that put all this in perspective for me, and I'm using his numbers from his book to share with you. He says that 850,000 gang members is about 0.3% of our United States population. Quote, depending on the year, this 0.3 of the population commits 6 to 8% of the violent crimes, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, unquote. So think about that. 0.3% of our country's population is said to be involved with gangs, and that 0.3% commits 6 to 8% of the violent crimes, and that is mostly done in large metro areas. Now, that percentage actually is increased, and I will get to that a little bit later. Smith says there's another aspect of this situation that's less quantifiable to American street gangs. It is their attitude towards violence. And by this, he means that street gang members commit homicides over what we would consider absolutely trivial issues. And let me read from the book an example. Quote, Ear Hustle is a very popular podcast recorded in California's San Quentin prison. In one episode, an inmate told his story about the murder that led to his incarceration. He was a member of one gang, let's say Gang X, and while in a bodega, another person came in and jokingly suggested that the future inmate was actually a member of rival Gang Y. So he shot him, all for the frivolous assertion of being in a rival gang, unquote. So to summarize what we're talking about, homicides, mainly homicides committed with a firearm, are statistically packed tightly in major or large metro areas. And the reason for this is that large metro areas have a high concentration of potential victims, gang and non-gang members, an oversized number of street gang members, the subculture or belief by gang members that it is okay to kill someone over insignificant things. This creates both a high demand among gang members for firearms and the willingness to use them. The people committing these violent crimes, the homicides, tend to be repeat offenders. Now, Smith writes about one gang member who was found guilty of murder, was also a lead suspect in two other murders. And he gave another example of a gang member who was a suspect for three cold case files. And my takeaway is that there's a multiplier factor with gun homicides, and that is the gang member. Gang members don't just commit one homicide, they can commit multiple homicides. And this takes us to the big question, and this is what Smith asks, quote, how do gang members and common criminals get their guns, unquote. And this is why I am talking about all this today. There's a correlation between gun availability and homicides, violent crime. Clearly, a felon cannot by law possess a firearm, but we all know that criminals do not follow laws, let alone gun laws. And Smith says this is the core question. And when those who would like to see more gun control provide statistics to make their arguments look relevant, they try to make it look like more crime is committed, more violent crimes are committed, simply because of the number of guns Americans own. And that gets back to the availability of guns, which relates to gun control. Now, Smith says that so far in his discussion and what I'm sharing with you from his chapter on gun availability, quote, one, general availability of guns is not predictive of gun violence population-wide, and two, large metropolitan areas with street gangs log disproportionate amount of gun crime, of violent gun crime and gun use, unquote. And we will finish this up around the corner after the commercial.
To play in Alaska is a year-round activity. So before you leave home, make sure your trailer is ready to roll. Wheel bearings to wiring and lights. Have it serviced at Arctic RV. Motorhomes, toy haulers, campers, bodywork to appliances. See their huge selection of RV parts as well. Alaska plays rough. Make sure you and your RV are ready for it with Arctic RV. Book your appointment now. Rough it in style. Arctic RV. Open all winter long at 30th and Pegger.
Hi. Hey, Steve with Auto Trim Design here. When I hear lights and sirens, I'm reminded of how fortunate we are to have our dedicated and heroic response personnel watching over us, because many times someone's life is on the line. Chances are we've installed those lights and equipped that vehicle with sirens, comms, and cameras. I'm proud that my team is picked for the dependable installations they need, as it shows how dependable our work is at Auto Trim Design. So if you're looking for accessories to outfit your personal rig, depend on the best. Depend on Auto Trim Design, 2550 South Cushman.
KFAR weather.
Mainly clear skies today with highs around 12. Winds out of the east, 5 to 10 miles per hour. Lows level off around 2 below. Tonight, partly cloudy skies. Highs level off around 16. Tomorrow, cloudy skies expected. About an inch of snow tomorrow night. And that's your weather on KFAR, 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm weatherology meteorologist Laura Lockwood. Currently, it's 7 degrees below zero.
And now, back to Shooter's Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM and 660 AM. Streaming live at KFARradio.com.
This is Shooter's Corner with Laura Berkowitz, KFAR Radio. Please call in 458-8255-458-TALK and tell us what's on your mind about firearms today. And I think I made a mess out of that quote because I was rushing to get to commercial break. So I'm just going to start there and re-quote, and then we'll move forward. So this is what I'm sharing with you from his guns availability chapter, quote, one, general availability of guns is not predictive of gun violence population-wide. And two, and this is the one I made a mess out of, large metropolitan areas with street gangs log a disproportionate amount of violent crime and gun crime, unquote. Okay, I got that right. Now, if this is true, why do we not see statistics showing absolutely and verifiably even higher numbers for gun violence for gangs? Because we don't. And here is what Smith says. And I want to read exactly what he says in his sidebar titled A Note on Confounding Data. One problem, quote, one problem with American criminology data is an adherence to confirmation. That's a term, confirmation. When one rolls through the 2017 FBI uniform crime statistics, they will see that only 6.4% of firearms homicide are ascribed to gang activity. You'll also notice that more than 43% of homicides have unknown circumstances and 20% are specifically classified as arguments. Another 11.7% did not have a classification. The data was left blank, unquote. Now, Smith goes on to describe a conversation he had with an Oakland, California detective about this very subject, and this is how he describes that conversation. Quote, if I get called to a scene and there's a body in an alley face down with an entry wound in the back of the skull and the victim is wearing Bloods colors in Crips territory, then I know this was a gang-related homicide. But without a witness, I have to log it as unknown. Unknown. If witnesses reported hearing two men shouting at one another right before a gunshot was heard, then I can log it as an argument homicide. But it was likely an argument about gun conflicts, unquote. And the takeaway is there is a disparity between direct measurement and cause and effect based on reported statistics of a crime as opposed to strict crime scene analysis. Now, the law enforcement on the ground in, let's say, a large metro area may know from their experience who or what group, like a gang member, committed the crime, but they're required to report the incident using standardized, strict crime scene analysis. So on the ground, the gang violence is much higher than actually reported. Smith says overly strict FBI data is underreporting the reality. So let's talk about where the guns that criminals use come from. Where do criminals source their guns? Does this have anything to do with the guns that are available to purchase at a gun store, online from FFL to FFL, or at gun shows? Smith says, quote, "The source of guns for all crimes is largely underground, and changing the laws about how guns are retailed made this number grow," unquote. Wow. Let me repeat that sentence so it sinks in. Quote, "The source of guns for all crimes is largely underground, and changing the laws about how guns are retailed made this number grow," unquote. Now, Smith has a chart in his book titled Sources of Firearms, and it shows the percentage of guns purchased or traded from different sources broken down into those sources. And one column is from 1997, before NICS, that's the National Instant Background Check System, and the other column is from 2004 forward, after implementation of the NICS system. And the NICS system was implemented in November 1998 as part of the Brady Handgun Violence Prevention Act of 1993. Now, the information Smith uses is gathered and provided by the Bureau of Justice Statistics. They periodically study where the guns used in violent crimes are sourced. And Smith tells us that from this information, we can learn more about the availability of guns and how criminals get them. Now, let me quote him. "Indeed, in all years where the BJS, that's the Bureau of Justice Statistics, has been documenting crime gun sources, a minimum of 40% of crime guns come from completely unregulatable underground supplies. By contrast, only 9.9% came from gun stores and pawn shops," unquote. But there's more. He also says another 37.4% of crime guns were acquired through family and friends. The term for that is acquaintance transfers. And it means that these guns were transferred from a family or friend to persons prohibited to own guns. And these transfers, prohibited and illegal as they are, can be from a family member giving a felon a spare gun, or perhaps they were gang members trading guns with one another. These transfers to felons are also, these transfers to felons also include the straw man purchases, where a criminal gets a person legal to purchase a firearm to claim it's for themselves, but the purchase is transferred to the criminal. And Smith says that the strawman purchases are statistically rare, but they do happen. Now, Smith takes his number that I mentioned earlier, 40% of crime guns coming from completely unregulated sources, and by adding to that number the 37.4% we just said came from family and friends, that adds up to 77.4%. So we can assume, if we use Smith's analysis, and he comes up with the same number, that 77% of the guns that criminals acquire and use in violent crimes come from unregulated sources, not from the local gun store, the gun show, the pawn shop, or any other legal source of guns that are available to all of us law-abiding citizens. That 77% number was an eye-opener to me. And here's something else interesting about crime access to firearms before and after the NICS was implemented. Smith tells us that after NICS went live, quote, "A little less than 3% of criminal acquisitions stopped being made at retail outlets and started being made in underground markets," unquote. And Smith takes this to mean that the NICS system moved the additional 3% of criminal firearms acquisitions from a traceable market, the FFL, to an underground or black market. Now, another problem is that in the underground gun markets, guns are what Smith calls recycled. He feels recycling of firearms used by criminals is both important and frustrating. He points out that guns are durable. Now, I was surprised to read that guns are indeed so durable that the majority of guns brought into gun buyback programs are antiques, maybe a little rusty, but still operational. Smith's point is, quote, This degree of durability means that once a gun leaks into the underground markets, it can have many owners in a relatively short amount of time, unquote. And something else I didn't realize, Smith notes that the transaction price of an underground black market gun is about $250 per gun. How he got that, he got that number by using a weighted average cost as reported in a study of Chicago criminals. And I had to laugh at that because I can't imagine a surveyor asking a criminal how he paid for his illegally acquired gun. Now, criminologists think one of these illegally owned guns can have a dozen or more owners. And what does that mean? Well, if one gun can have a dozen or more owners that commit crimes with that one gun, then the total number of guns in the underground market does not have to be a large number. The number of illegal gun owners per gun is the multiplier for the high gun violence rate. It isn't one gun per one criminal. It might be the same gun for a number of criminals. The gun is simply recycled in the underground market. So think about this. If our government further restricts guns, it's likely because of this multiplier of use factor that new restrictions will have very little effect on criminal gun use. The guns already in the market will simply cycle through more users so they can continue to commit more crimes. And honestly, this is why I love this book. I've learned new ways to think about this whole subject. Now, Smith's takeaway here is, quote, gun durability and the recycling of guns in underground networks also helps to explain the long amount of time between when a gun is sold at a licensed gun store and when it is recovered in a crime scene, and the short amount of time from when a street criminal acquires a gun and when they are caught with it. It takes almost forever for a gun to make the journey, but a thug caught with a gun got it very recently, unquote. So this was news to me, too. I found out from his book that the BATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, reports on what is termed time to crime. Quote, that is the amount of time between when a gun is sold by an FFL and when it is recovered at a crime scene, unquote. Can you guess what that average time would be? In 2017, the average time to crime was 9.3 years, according to Smith. And Smith notes an earlier study done by the BATF in Chicago that showed only 6.6% of guns used in crime were retailed within 6 months of use. The takeaway from Smith is that very few criminals acquire their guns at gun stores, much less buy them and use them shortly afterward. The underground or black market operates differently. There, criminals can acquire guns quickly and buy them cheaply. I said earlier the average price was about $250. The dynamic here for purchase and use of the gun in a crime are different than when guns purchased by someone legitimately held and then long after the purchase finding its way to an underground market. Now, Smith cites one small study that showed once criminals purchase a gun on the black market, they use that gun soon after purchase. And if those guns are recovered, if they're recovered, they're recovered by law enforcement within 2 months on average. Now, according to Smith, quote, and this is very interesting, that is 112 months from when the gun was sold at retail and only 2 months from when it was acquired off the street. This helps illustrate that for the bulk of gun violence, moderating the retailing of guns has little to no effect, unquote. That 112 months Smith refers to is what I earlier mentioned as the time to crime, which is 9.3 years. 9.3 years is 112 months. So if the gun is purchased by someone legal to have it and it's purchased from an FFL, it can take 112 months on average for it to make its way somehow into the underground market. And from there, if a criminal purchases it on the underground market, it's usually used in a crime recovered by law enforcement in about 2 months on average. And here's something else Smith clears up. Let's see, I've got about a minute.
40 seconds.
Okay, I'm going to save this for next week, and I hope to finish this entire chapter next week. I hope you found it interesting and informative. A lot of this goes right back to that opinion piece. I wish that lady would read these books and learn this. Just remember, folks, always keep the gun pointed in a safe direction. Always keep your finger off the trigger until ready to shoot. Always keep the gun unloaded until ready to use, and teach gun safety to everybody you know. I'll talk to you next week.
This has been Shooter's Corner on KFAR Radio. Brought to you by Rogers Auto Repair, Arctic RV, Auto Trim Design, and Frontier Outfitters. To listen back to this or past episodes of Shooter's Corner, go to KFARradio.com and click on the archives page. For more Shooter's Corner on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.